Good morning.
Morning.
So this morning I'm giving my last talk in a series on Taoism and Buddhism coming together to create Zen. And in my first two talks, I talked about Buddhism, restraint, discipline, and work. Anybody doing anything here that involves restraint, discipline, and work? And Taoism, laughter, play, and spontaneity. And I talked about Buddhism, iconic perfection, the icon there, the icon, striving for perfection. Buddhism and Taoism, iconoclasm, imperfection, flawedness. Oh my goodness, we're all flawed. And I talked about the third one, conceptual teaching, verbal teaching, scriptures, hundreds and hundreds of scriptures and books, and all that stuff, Buddhism, and Taoism, the natural world as a teacher, the sky, the sun, the earth, the trees. And today, I'm going to talk about Buddhism. Sensual desire creates suffering. Taoism, sensual pleasure is joyful. So let's start with sensual pleasure. So the most powerful sensual pleasure that we know about as human beings is sex, right? In case you didn't notice it. And I'm an old guy. I grew up in the 40s and 50s in a totally repressed, shut down time. Infants never saw their mother's breast when I was growing up. Bottle-fed babies were healthier. And it was more moral to have to feed your baby with a bottle. And the formulas were scientifically proven. This was science. This was morality. But it was really repression. The breast was obscene. I never even saw a nipple, my mother's nipple, until I saw a Playboy magazine when I was in the ninth grade. Someone snuck me a Playboy magazine. I thought, oh, that's what a breast looks like. Woo! Right? Woo! Corporate America. And now what's happened? We've gone to the other end of the spectrum. Just in the last 50 years, we're hypersexualized. It's a hypersexualized society. Consumer culture. Sex sells. The pendulum has swung so far that when I was director of an agency with a lot of employees, the worst problem we had that the HR people would tell me was people watching porn during work hours. That was the worst problem we had. Jeez, if my parents had known about that, they wouldn't believe it. 35% of internet downloads are porn. 35%. 70% of men between 18 and 24 years old watch porn. I got this from Google, so it's got to be right. I don't have to read books anymore. Who reads books anymore? Just Google it. So, let me talk first a little bit about Buddhist culture and Buddhist attitude, and then the Taoist attitude and how they come together. So, Pali Canon, oldest canon. Here's a statement. If one longing for sensual pleasure achieves it, yes, he's enraptured at heart. The mortal gets what he wants. But afterward, the pleasure diminishes. He's shattered, as if shot with an arrow. Whoever avoids sensual desires as he would with his foot the head of a snake, goes beyond, mindful of his attachment to the world. So one, always mindful, should avoid sensual desires. Letting them go, he crosses over the flood like one who, having bailed out the boat, has reached the far shore. So you find a lot of this in the early scriptures. And people who were serious about meditating became ordained, and they were expected to be celibate. And of course they had a hard life. First, before they did the monasteries, they traveled around by foot and begged and had a difficult life. So if they'd been sexually involved, it would have been difficult for them to maintain their practice, because they were just trying to get along. They ate what was offered, what was given to them in their begging bowls, and they needed to be one-pointed. They needed to conserve their energy. Then the monasteries developed, first in India, then in China, the big monasteries. And in the monasteries, the emphasis was on sitting meditation and leading a rigorous life so you could break through all of your worries and confusion to the stillness that's here. So sex would just distract from that. Plus, the lay people were supporting these monasteries. If the lay people didn't want to support the monasteries, if the monks were in there screwing around literally and physically, you know, that was reality. That was reality. So in Buddhism, sex was never considered immoral or sinful. It's just that the libido is so strong that it can distract us from a meditation practice and from really seriously engaging in a deep meditation practice. We want to wake up to our own interdependent nature, and sex doesn't really help us do that very much. So in the early Buddhism, the monks had only one robe, and the nuns only had one robe. Then as they went into China, they got a second robe, and in Japan, a third robe, so three layers of robes, but still monocolor, no color. Black for monks, priests, nuns in training, no color, because color is sexual. You could get excited. I could get excited if you had a Hawaiian shirt on right now. My libido could get out of control. So luckily you don't. Right? So only one robe, two robes, three robes, no color, shaved heads. Asexual. There was a reason they shaved their heads. Asexual. Now, you know, in our culture where it's kind of cool for men to have a shaved head, and now women, we don't get that. But that was the impetus behind it. That was the impetus behind it. And no mixed gender. I mean, men and women never meditated together. Never. They weren't even supposed to look at each other if they were serious meditators. So then we have Buddhism coming to America in the form of Zen, and I'll get to this a little bit later, but this no mixed gender reminds me of a story. So I'm sitting in a meditation hall in San Francisco in the 60s, where the women are not very clothed, and they're sitting right next to the men. And I have a female sitting across from me during a retreat who's quite well endowed, and has, what do you call this? What's it called when you don't have something on your shoulders? I can't remember. Huh? Yeah, a tube top. She has a tube top. So I'm sitting, and then I get up, and we bow to each other. And that destroys my meditation for the rest of the day. My dentition is destroyed. And I think, oh, that's what those Buddhists were talking about. That's what they're doing. That's the deal there. It's not that they're puritanical. It's just that I can't think of anything else but this woman. And all of her different iterations. Right? So, in a way, Zazen, doing meditation, is sensory deprivation, isn't it? We're sitting facing a wall. We're not sitting facing some mandala with wonderful Buddhas and Taras. We're just sitting facing a black wall. And we're noticing our desires as they come up, as they cycle through endlessly. We're just alone with them in the wall. Nothing to distract us. No way to fulfill those desires, but we can begin to see how consuming each of them is. And then we can begin to accept them and not get wigged out by them. And when the bell rings, what happens? Usually the desire just is gone. Whatever it is, it's just gone. So how quickly they dissipate. How quickly they dissipate. And we're learning to be intimate with them, aren't we? We're learning not to be caught by them. We're learning to actually see them, although this takes a while, as butterflies lighting on our shoulders. Oh, here's this one, a swallowtail. Now I've got a painted lady. Now I've got a few cabbage butterflies. And I just watching them. They fly away. Oh, then they come back. Then they fly away, but they're light. We don't have to take them seriously. We don't have to get all wigged out by them because they're just butterflies. Just butterflies. But it takes practice to do that in the sensory deprivation chamber that is Zazen. It takes practice. And a second sensory desire that Buddhism is little concerned about is food. Not as much as sex, but food. And early monks and nuns had one meal a day, which they begged for. And then as things progressed, they only ate until noon, nothing after noon. And then as things progressed, people wanted more. So then they said, oh, well, in Mahayana Buddhism, we can have a third meal, but it will just be a medicinal meal. And, you know, it's just your medicine, so you don't eat very much. So we try to do this in retreats here, but the third meal is the one I like the best. So I take a lot of medicine. I need it. I'm the teacher. The teacher needs more medicine. And so when I lived at the Zen monastery in California, there was a guy there named Ed Brown who was my friend, who wrote Tassajara Cooking and Tassajara Bread Book. So it was a hard life. We got up really early and sat in the morning. We did manual labor. We sat. We did manual labor. But we had the best food. He baked food all the time, Ed did. And we had just wonderful food. So, and, you know, we were too exhausted, although it was men and women, we were too exhausted to have sex, frankly. Well, I'm just speaking for myself. I better not speak for the others. From the sitting, you know, at 4 a.m., doing the manual labor, sitting again, doing more manual labor, sitting again. But we got food. So food was what we talked about. What would Ed cook for lunch? Weren't those muffins for breakfast good? What did they muffins have in them? And on and on. That was something we could talk about. That was something we could talk about. And we did. Talked a lot about nothing else. Nothing else. So I was talking to my teacher about this. I don't know what we were saying. I said, oh, these are good muffins. And my teacher said, yes. This food. And I said, yes, it's really good, isn't it? He said, yes, maybe too good. Because he was noticing how wigged out everybody was getting by the food and how they were just fixating on it. And, and it became their salvation, the next muffin. So that's why we need to be careful about food, too. From a Buddhist perspective, at least. I do the Taoist perspective next. From the Buddhist perspective, the desire is relieved by getting something we want. But is the desire really relieved by the getting the something? Or is it relieved because the state of desire has ended? So let's say I like bittersweet chocolate. Let's say that I indulge myself and go to Lund's and get, I only like 80% or more bittersweet. Well, that's because there's less sugar and I feel more pure and all that stuff, right? So 80, and it tastes better too. 80, so I find 80%. I eat my chocolate, and you know, if I go to Lund's to get chocolate, if I make a special trip, now would I make a special trip? Well, Lund's is only a 2 blocks from where I live, and I walk by Lund's every day, so I don't even have to make a special trip. But I do have to go in there, and for a while I was not allowed to have sugar at all because of my Lyme's disease, but now I'm having sugar, so although I'm supposed to have it very moderately. Okay, so let's say I have a little chocolate. There's a temporary relief, right? I feel really good. The wanting has stopped. But what happens? Next time I have low energy or I'm anxious, what comes in my mind? Chocolate. And it's not the chocolate itself that really satisfies me. It's the letting go of the desire and not being caught in the wanting anymore. And we can see this happens over and over again to us when we're not caught in the wanting anymore. And then when we get anxious again, we get caught in the wanting. So this is the human situation. We all do this. And in a consumer culture, it's just all over the place. Looking outside, a consumer culture says you can get it from outside. And we engage again and again in trying to get the pleasure. But in Zen, we say the freedom comes from seeing and fully experiencing the thoughts, the sensations, the fantasies that make up the desire, just letting them rest on our shoulders, even if they're heavy in our meditation, and letting them be there, feeling them until they dissolve. And they come back again, but they dissolve. They dissolve. And then we have more control over our lives. We're not just caught by that stuff, because we see that it's just made up stuff, just made up in our Darwinian consciousness, which is pretty strong for all of us. And when our life's totally out of control or we're experiencing some loss, then we get intoxicated easily by sensual desire, right? Overeating, overstimulation, constant entertainment. So after we've had the chocolate and the pleasure diminishes, we can feel some loss, some frustration. But craving triggers alienation, and alienation triggers more craving, on and on and on and on. So that's Buddhism. Now, I'm going to talk about Taoism and how they come together. So, Buddhism, as I said, really is, it tells us to pay attention to sensual desire and not see how we're getting caught by it. And allow it just to come through without either indulging it or repressing it as much as possible. And that's sensual desire. Well, Taoism isn't even actually talking about sensual desire. It's talking about sensual pleasure. So actually the two do complement one another. Because Buddhism said, be careful, be wary of sensual desire. And Taoism says, enjoy sensual pleasure. So they come together and create Zen. if it doesn't interfere with your commitment to do your meditation practice, to live a more meditative life, then the sexual activity or the food eating activity is just fine. In Zen itself, there's no moral code. There's no differentiation between even the, we don't, in, when I was a kid, there was a huge differentiation between reproductive and recreational sex. I'm told that among the, in the younger generation, that's no longer the case. I don't know. I don't see enough people here who look young to ask that question. But I'm told there's no difference. Well, some would say, and I'm told that hooking up is as common as dating. And, you know, from a moralistic point of view, that sounds not good. But as long as there's mutual understanding and respectfulness, what's good and what's bad? The problem is when there's a lack of mutual understanding and respectfulness. We appreciate the intrinsic pleasure of the sun's warmth, of the sound of the rain, of a good meal. So why not a sexual experience from the Taoist point of view and from the Zen point of view? Because remember, Zen is an amalgamation of Taoism and Buddhism. So when I was young, when I was very young, and living in San Francisco, I didn't know anything about homosexuality or gay. But then I got exposed in San Francisco, even back then, to a couple of guys who were gay, although I don't even know what the word was then. I think we said homosexual. Yeah, we're homosexual. And that was, you know, that's 50 years ago, 55 years ago. And I was repulsed by it. Seemed unnatural. But, you know, then I got to know some people who had that orientation, and I became friends with them. And I began to think, oh, it's not so unnatural after all. I thought it was weird, unnatural stuff, but I say it's just natural stuff. And about 20 years later, someone who was transsexual hit me up once, and I thought, God, that is weird. That's weird. That's unnatural. Well, then I got to know some people who had transsexual orientations, and I thought, well, it doesn't seem too unnatural. And they told me more about their lives and what they'd struggled with and how they'd been dissed by society. It seemed more and more natural. After a while, it seemed completely natural. So people who have different beliefs than ours, different practices, they're peculiar or strange until we get to know them. They are peculiar or strange. We have sharp edges that our zazen, that our meditation, we hope will dull the sharpness of those edges. That when we come up against the other person that seems weird, though our sharp edges stick out. But in meditation, we learn to soften those edges, to round them out, so that our edges are smooth. And instead of saying, that is natural, this is unnatural, whatever it is natural, because it's what is, as long as it's not hurting someone, as long as it's not hurting yourself or someone, as long as it's not casting someone out of your heart. When we do this natural, unnatural thing or any kind of separation, we're casting that person out of our heart. So in Zen, we emphasize, as you guys, most of you know, intimacy. Intimacy. Instead of being separated from the other person, from the activity, from whatever we're doing, by just incessantly regretting, reviewing, rehearsing, repeating, regretting, reviewing, rehearsing, repeating. We can't really be intimate when we're doing that, can we? We can't really be engaged when we're doing that. We see that, and we walk that goal, and we're fully engaged. Whether it's walking in the rain, or being involved in some sexual activity, being vulnerable, allowing us to be vulnerable in all activities. Open and receptive to the pleasure or pain of the person we're with and our own pleasure or pain. Even recreational sex is more pleasurable and fulfilling if it involves intimacy. Now, it might seem fleeting or superficial to me as an older guy when I see these young people doing that. But that's my judgment, right? That's my judgment. And, of course, it's not appropriate. No kind of sexual expression is appropriate or healthy if it involves adults and minors, teachers and students, or any situation where there's a power differential. That's just it. That's just not. How can it be respectful? How can there be a sense of interdependence and mutuality? No. And then there's promiscuity. Promiscuity usually means there's an emotional issue being avoided. And there's suffering with promiscuity. It masks our insecurity. It masks our loneliness. It conceals our underlying fear of intimacy. Or maybe our underlying idealism. No one fits my image of how he or she should be, so I'll just have casual sex with that person. But what we're talking about in Zen and in Taoist Zen, because Zen is both Taoist and Buddhism, is the intrinsic joy of just being in the world, just being alive. And there is intimacy with that. There's a feeling of connection with that. The joy that's not connected isn't a joy that lasts. It's a joy that is so ephemeral it's just gone. But any kind of abiding joy involves some sense of connection. So now I want to talk about EQ. Raise your hand if you know who EQ is. Only two or three or four of you. So EQ, Zen master who lived in the 16th century. I think we actually did a practice period on EQ. I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago. Crazy Cloud, EQ. So EQ was concerned, and he's very famous in Japan, very famous. EQ, Crazy Cloud, was concerned in his day about the hypocritical attitude towards sexuality in Japanese Buddhism, in Japanese Zen. And what was happening was that clandestinely, the priests and monks were having homosexual and heterosexual experiences clandestinely. And the abbots, he writes about the abbots having concubines in the back of behind their rooms in the back of the monasteries. And so he wanted to bring this all out and not hide it anymore. And his point of view was that if it's hidden, there's not a sense of connection. There's not a sense of openness. So he said the sacred's not separate from the profane. And he drank sake, he did meditation, and he had sex with men and women. And he was open about it. He called it the red thread Zen. Did you do the practice period when we talked about EQ?
I remember that, yeah. 3 different bullets. Yeah, and we came up with a slogan, what would EQ do?
So for EQ, exuberant love of the sacred and the profane in his life and in his poetry. So I'm going to read a few of his poems. A meal of fresh octopus. Lots of arms, just like Kanon, the goddess, sacrificed for me, spiced with saffron. I revere it so. The taste of the sea, just divine. Sorry, Buddha, this is another precept I just cannot keep. Here's another one. A man's root. 8 inches strong. It's my favorite thing. If I'm alone at night, I embrace it fully. A beautiful woman hasn't touched it for ages. Within my shorts, there is an entire universe. Next one. A woman's sex. It has the original mouth, but remains worthless. It is surrounded by a magnificent mound of hair. Sentient beings can get completely lost in it. But it is also the birthplace of the Buddhas of the 10,000 worlds. I could read a lot of more of his poems, but I'm going to keep going here. So then he writes. He writes about this story, this famous Zen story. Long ago, there was an old woman who had supported a hermit monk for 20 years. She had a 16-year-old girl bring him meals. One day, she instructed the girl to embrace the monk and ask, "How do you feel right now?" The young girl did as told, and the monk's response was, "I'm an old withered tree against a frigid cliff on the coldest day of winter." I don't know. When the girl returned and repeated the monk's words, the old woman exclaimed, "For 20 years I've been supporting that base worldling." She chased the monk away and burned the hermitage down. So EQ says, the old woman was big-hearted enough to elevate the pure monk with a girl to wed. Tonight, if a beauty were to embrace me, my withered old willow branch would sprout a new shoot. As EQ aged, he quit going to prostitutes and fell in love with a blind woman named Mori, younger blind woman, Lady Mori, who he stayed with for the rest of his life. And here's a poem to her. To Lady Mori, with deepest gratitude and thanks. The tree was barren of leaves, but you brought a new spring. Long green sprouts, verdant flowers, fresh promise. Mori, if I ever forget my profound gratitude to you, let me burn in hell forever. So now I'd like to talk for a minute about, or maybe 5 minutes, about orgasm and enlightenment. Why not? Why not? So, first similarities and then differences, okay? So both. With both, time and thought stop. With both, insecurities and concerns drop away. With both, even though it may be very temporarily with orgasm, the small self is forgotten. Both are altered states of consciousness. Both may be followed by crystal clear awareness. You must know what I mean. 2011 Scientific American explored this, and their conclusions were, bliss, both sacred and profane, shares the diminishment of self-awareness, alterations in bodily perceptions, and decreased sense of pain. Differences. Enlightenment arises from a deep meditative state and may result in a permanent life-changing, permanent life change of your life. It may not, but it may, including clarity, expansiveness, spaciousness, not generally present in orgasm. Now, some of you may have had an orgasm that I haven't had, but generally not present. Two, there's a sense of an immediate presence of a huge reality that includes everything. And finally, there's a deep stillness, a deep calmness. In orgasm, bodily sensations are intense rather than calm, and awareness is absorbed by the body, which is cool, rather than expanding. So here's some research that was done on this. And this is the, I'm citing the results of this research done on meditative states and orgasm. Pleasure derived from meditative states and that of an orgasm light up different parts of the brain. Meditation lights up the left prefrontal cortex, which is associated with joy and happiness. During an orgasm, this area of the brain is dark. A sustained meditation practice increases the amount of gray matter in our brain by thickening the prefrontal cortex, indicating a permanent change, which orgasm does not. So, from the Zen point of view, there's no need to renounce enjoying our meal, enjoying sex. No need to renounce. Those experiences also diminish our sense of a separate, isolated self, even if only temporarily. We can enjoy bodily pleasures. They're wonderful, as long as we're compassionate. As long as we're compassionate. As long as we maintain our boundaries. So my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, is known pretty well for this statement. He had one of those tank top women approach him. I don't know if she was a tank top woman. I'm just making that up. Now that, I couldn't remember what it was even called, but now you told me it was tank top. One of those tank top women, they were all fluttering around there in San Francisco in those days. Approach him and tell him that she was deeply in love with him. And he said to her, "It's okay to feel whatever you feel for your teacher. It's just perfectly all right. I have enough strength for both of us. I have enough strength for both of us." So we can cultivate that strength, can't we? We can cultivate it. He didn't judge. He didn't lecture. He didn't make her feel awkward or weird. We don't have to judge ourselves. We don't have to lecture. Haven't we lectured ourselves enough? We don't have to make the other person or ourselves feel natural, awkward, or weird just because we think they're unnatural. What's that all about? Desire is just desire. An emotion is just emotion. It doesn't have any valence. Just what it is. So now I'm going to close with a poem by Mary Oliver, which is in your program. And now, when I read this poem, I want you to see if you can find the four elements of Taoist Zen that I've been talking about in my last three talks. The playfulness, the first element. The immersion in nature, the second element. The appreciation of flawedness and imperfection, the third element. And the joy of sensory experience. So now I'll read the poem. And then we'll have some discussion. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue sky, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. Now, Mary Oliver never talks about Zen, which is all the better. All the better. So that's what I want to say for this morning, and I'll be glad to entertain any questions or comments about anything, natural or unnatural. Yeah, Larry, welcome back.
Thank you. Just a something I was thinking about when we were talking about desire and pleasure. How do you distinguish between desire and pleasure? Desire, to me, seems to cause pleasure. Pleasure can cause desire. How do you distinguish?
Well, I may desire that the sun would come out today so that I can go running or so I can go walking. I desire that. And I keep looking out the window and I think, God, it's not going away. Well, when is it going to come out? Then I go on my iPhone and say, well, I find it at 2:30. You know, now we do everything hourly on our 2:30. It's going to come out. Oh, I'm really desiring that sun to come out. And then at 2:30, my iPhone lets me down. It's still raining. So then I think, I should just move to the Caribbean permanently. There I could have all my desire for sun, being a California boy, fulfilled instead of staying in this stupid part of the world. Sorry. But, you know. So that's desire. Pleasure. Oh, I noticed the mist coming in this morning from my car, and just kind of gently I felt it on my shoulders. It wasn't even rain, and it just felt good. I wasn't desiring. I was just noticing. I was just being with it. And it was pleasing. It was pleasing. So that's a difference. That's a difference. Anybody want to follow up on that? Or?
Tim?
Yeah.
Learning about emptiness.
Yes, she's taking. I'm gonna tell people what you're saying, unless you're gonna use a really large voice. She's taking the Heart Sutra class, and she's learning about emptiness. Good luck. She didn't say that. I said that.
So this is very good talk for me today, because last week in class, my question, which didn't fully get satisfied, was, okay, I've just learned to become aware of the emptiness, and that's, I think, very rooted in the Buddhist tradition.
Uh-huh.
Finding relief in meditation and emptiness. And my question for the teacher was, well, it seems we're missing something if we sit in meditation and are never allowing ourselves to experience love and joy and pleasure.
Uh-huh.
And today your talk just really hit home for me that there's this whole other part of Zen, the Taoist part, that answers that question. So.
Oh, good. Yes. So the reason we do this sensory deprivation exercise for a half hour a day or an hour a day or whatever you do, 20 minutes a day, is so that we can clear our senses up, and then when we feel some rain or when we're with our partner and wanting to be amorous, we can just do it. We can just enjoy it. We can just love it. So the two really do complement each other, I think, but not always. They don't always complement each other, and we get confused. And you know, we say in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness. That means that all forms are changing. That means that none of them really will satisfy us ultimately. They're empty, and they're because everything is in interdependent flow. But we also say emptiness is form. So as we settle into realizing that we can't really depend on any of these forms to give us the satisfaction we want, we begin to enjoy each of the forms. Because as it comes up, each of the butterflies. So I say these are butterflies on your shoulders, and someone came to me in meditation and said, they're not butterflies. They're awful, smelly rats on my shoulder. Well, okay. They're awful smelly rats on our shoulder. But if we get to know those awful smelly rats, they have a life too. That's part of our desire. And they come and go too. And the more we experience their coming and going, everything, the more we can just enjoy being where we are. How's that?
I'm starting to see the whole picture. I think.
What?
On that particular question that I had.
Oh, I didn't answer all your questions? Well, I'm a Zen teacher. My answer is supposed to include all your questions. Well, only one. My teacher used to say, I only say one thing over and over again. He said, you're going to write this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He said, but I've only said one thing. And we had one book, two books, three books, four books. What else? We have a little time? Yeah, Darla.
I think one of the things that I noticed so much during retreat or session, we talk about it being a sensory deprivation experience, and I am learning so much how it's completely the opposite of that.
Huh.
You notice that your ears never turn off. That your eyes never turn off, but you never actually stop smelling things.
Ah.
You know? They're going all the time. Even when you have your eyes shut, it's not like your eyes shut down. It's not. You have something in front of them. And then you really start noticing how there's never nothing there. Like, you just happen to maybe hear one of the 20 cars on a normal day. And when you're sitting in here and it's quiet, maybe you hear 18 of them. But they never stop. It's just that we don't pay attention.
That's right. And there's some pleasure in just hearing the car go by. Just hearing it with no rejecting it. The car going by is a beautiful river of sound. It's a beautiful river of sound. Thank you, darling. Thank you. Anybody else?
I would like to recommend a book.
Pardon?
A book that I find very interesting, and it talks about this. Always having things, either physical or our emotions, thoughts, feelings, are always having these things. It's called The Unfettered Soul.
It's called what?
It's called Singing.
I couldn't understand.
Can you pronounce it better?
Untethered.
Pardon?
Untethered.
Untethered soul. I see. Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.